I think the flexibility comes into play to retain women in the workforce and either help them not off-ramp as readily after they have children, or to on-ramp faster than they would have been when there's more traditional, kind of less viable, less nimble arrangements. Just quite honestly, that traditional workplace was designed for a family structure a long time ago, and this new modern flexible workforce is designed for the majority of needs that, I'll say women, but quite honestly, it's not just about women. I would often say that work flexibility is wanted and needed by almost all of us at some point in our careers.
I'm your host, Michelle King, and you're listening to The Fix, a podcast that shares the stories of women and men who are innovating and taking action to advance equality in the workplace and beyond. The first law in the United States that called for an 8-hour workday was passed in Illinois in 1867. But it wasn't until more than 70 years after the Illinois law that all full-time workers in the United States were required to be paid overtime if they worked more than 40 hours a week. Prior to the 8-hour workday, many Americans who worked primarily in manufacturing would routinely clock 10 or even 12-hour days. By and large, the 8-hour workday was created to protect workers who held jobs brought about by the Industrial Revolution. Many manufacturing and industrial jobs that laws were created for either don't exist anymore, or at least don't exist in the United States. Work has changed incredibly over the last century, even decade. And while jobs have changed, workplaces have been slow to catch up. Sitting at a desk for 8 hours a day is not really needed. Most employees can work from anywhere and outside of the 8-hour time frame, and increasingly organizations need them to. Yet for some reason, many workplaces still cling to the outdated idea of managing employees' working lives to a strict 8-hour workday. This doesn't actually work for anyone, including organizations. According to a July 2019 FlexJob survey of more than 2,000 women and children 18 and younger living at home, 31% of women who took a break in their career after having kids wanted to keep working, but reported that their job was too inflexible to remain in the workforce. 42% said it was either extremely difficult or difficult to restart their career after taking a break. Mothers with young children are less likely to be in the labor force than those with older children, and flexible work options play a role. But it is not enough to just have a flexible workplace policy. We need to ensure companies don't unfairly penalize men and women for using it. This is a cultural issue because we need to change the way flexible or remote work is valued and how we in turn value those who use it. On this episode, you'll be hearing from Sarah Sutton, founder and CEO of FlexJobs, who'll share their latest research findings which highlight why flexible work options are the key to making workplaces work for men and women. Flexibility is the umbrella term used to describe any role that breaks from the traditional rigid 9-to-5, 5-day-a-week structure. Flexible work gives individuals greater freedom over when, where, or how to fulfill their particular role. But it is a term we typically associate with mothers. The flexibility stigma is really the penalty mothers pay for taking up flexible work, as their workplaces perceive them to be less ambitious, motivated, and productive. This limits career advancement and pay. Importantly, this is an issue for men too, as research finds men who want to reduce their work hours for family reasons will be penalized. It's estimated they'll face a 26% reduction in pay, compared to women who'll face a 23% reduction. Given that mothers are still largely responsible for dependent care, the lack of flexible work options is still a major issue. Mothers with young children are less likely to be in the labor force than those with older children, and part of this is due to the lack of flexible work options. Flexible work arrangements, like working from home or with a flexible schedule, are something that employees want. A UK survey found that 92% of millennials identify flexibility as a top priority when job hunting. 80% of women and 52% of men want flexibility in their next role. And most over 50s want to ease slowly into retirement through reducing hours and working flexibly. However, fewer than 10% of UK jobs advertised currently offer flexibility. The gap between supply and demand is huge. Here, Sarah explains why this is.
Over time, as the kind of socioeconomic makeup of families have changed, there are more families now working than 50 years ago, for example, where there are dual income families, both parents working, and or there's been a significant growth in single parent families, more oftentimes mothers. So the ability to juggle the home and family and child responsibilities has gotten harder with less time available to do that. So the flexibility that remote work offers particularly becomes really significant in allowing women to stay in the workforce. They are able to save money on things like the commute and oftentimes can have a little more flexibility with their schedule in terms of getting things done. If they have to, you know, pop to school to pick up their kid because they're sick, they can get that work done afterwards and on a more flexible manner. So I think the flexibility comes into play to retain women in the workforce and either help them not off-ramp as readily after they have children, or to on-ramp faster than they would have been when there's more traditional, kind of less viable, less nimble arrangements. Just quite honestly, that traditional workplace was designed for a family structure a long time ago. And this new modern flexible workforce is designed for the majority of needs that I'll say women, but quite honestly, it's not just about women. I would often say that work flexibility is wanted and needed by almost all of us at some point in our careers.
Flexible working allows everyone, especially women, to manage both work and home life. Previous studies have shown that flexible working allows mothers to maintain their working hours after childbirth and to remain in senior roles. It also gives men an opportunity to spend time with their family and explore their identities outside of work. This results in increased satisfaction with work-life balance. In this sense, flexible working is a critical tool to further advance gender equality.
I'm one of the believers that work flexibility, and whether that's even concerning with what was traditionally called maternity leave and is now called family leave, but essentially until it's adopted by both men and women, it's not going to truly be equitable. And men need to get involved, and more are in families, which is wonderful. But that flexibility does allow men to help out and take on a load of the housework and family work that is historically and by all studies disproportionately falling to women. So I think that the ability to have more time in our lives is really special. Most people, when they become parents, want to be good parents. And by having more time, that allows you to have more time to dedicate your children and to dedicate your community and being involved in their schools and picking them up and taking them to sports or coaching sports and all of these different things. In fact, we've done surveys over the years of working parents and why they want flexibility. And one of the data points I've always loved is that we ask parents if they had a more flexible job or if they have a flexible job, did it cause them to get more involved in their children's communities or schools in the form of volunteer work? And over 75% say that they had volunteered more or would start volunteering if they had a more flexible job. And that's a really significant data point, and it can have a profound effect on their children, on their communities, and kind of on the fabric that we want to instill of involvement.
Making flexible work work for men and women can only happen if companies create the right culture to support it. Without this, people are not only discouraged from using flexible working, but they're also penalized when they do. Research examining the flexibility stigma found that men who take up leave after the birth of their child are less likely to get promoted or receive raises. Research examining the flexibility stigma found that men who take up leave after the birth of their child are less likely to get promoted or receive raises. Also, women who decide to take up maternity leave or reduced hours had to contend with the same issues as well as less meaningful work assignments. Here, Sarah explains this issue in more detail.
There are a lot of historical stigmas associated with working from home, and most of them have some element that people won't really be working if you aren't watching them. I kind of equate it to the concept of helicopter parenting, that, you know, the helicopter parenting where you're micromanaging everything your kids do was a one point seen as a positive thing and now very much has shown that it's not, because we're not giving our children enough independence to grow and to thrive and to make decisions of their own and to kind of really live up to their potential. And I would say it's similar with the views on remote work, that the way we used to work in an office, managers micromanage. They rely on this lazy, I call it lazy management, of that if you're there and I see you and you kind of look busy, then you must be being productive. And it's a comfort level thing, and I get that, but that was based on a time when we only could be in person. We didn't have virtual and cloud-based work platforms and mobile devices and all that stuff. Now that we do, we very much have the capability to be productive when we're not in sight. And so in my mind, and what studies show, is that being in an office does not make you more productive. And in fact, there are many studies that show that you waste upwards of 3 hours, and some of them even as high as 5 and 6 hours I've seen, in terms of office environments are not always that conducive to productive work. There are a lot of interruptions. There are a lot of noises. There's a lot of politics. There's kind of water cooler talk, which I know that there's some people say that can be incredibly beneficial, but it also can be very negative. There can be cliques, there can be stress, there can be bullying. It can be a really unhealthy work environment. We've probably all worked in them at some point in our careers. So I think that remote work, when you look at the different studies, whether it's Stanford's study a few years ago or Gallup's study that it looked at productivity and engagement, and in that particular one, they looked at whether remote work was offered at certain kind of tiers, so 0%, so no remote working, and then they looked at it in 20% increments, and in every increment other than zero, so every increment above zero showed more productivity and engagement with remote work. And that's something that employers need to be paying attention to. We do surveys internally, and we ask our audience kind of where, if they had a huge, significant project they had to get done, where do they think they could get it done in the best manner? And less than 15% say in the office during working hours. When you start to hear that, you know, the way we're working is broken if we're not giving people the ownership or the flexibility to do their best work where, when, and how they can.
It's estimated that by 2030, most professionals will work from home. Most companies will have a mix of permanent physical office locations and chains of interconnected hubs with different plans for individuals to access space. Meetings will routinely occur virtually and across geographies and time zones, rendering air travel unnecessary. As offices will become increasingly redundant, so too will office hours. If companies want to prepare for the future world of work, they need to start by creating cultures that support flexible work.
It is generally around fear. That concept of FaceTime, if you can see somebody working, you think they're being productive. The other thing is the personal connection. I think humans are, we like to be integrated. We like to connect in many cases. And so if you have a colleague who shows up on time every day and is, you know, well-dressed and tells really funny jokes, you know, in the coffee room, you like them. You get to know them in a more easy, organic way. And I think there is some beauty in that, but it's not unequivocally good. And I think that's one of the things that companies don't realize, especially when they're talking about remote work and they're talking about why it won't work for them, because they often refer to the water cooler benefit, you know, that dynamic synergy that just magically happens when people organically get together and these brilliant ideas come up at the water cooler. Well, that can be true, but it also is a ton of wasted time. And if you're an introvert, that water cooler time is often kind of dreadful. Or if you're in an environment where there are business cliques, and it absolutely happens, or if you're in a work environment where there's a lot of political rally, like, you know, jockeying, that can be really unhealthy. There are a lot of studies that show that mental health issues that are dormant in people are often triggered by workplace stress, depression and anxiety, let alone commute stress. So the workplace, by definition, is not healthy. You have to create a healthy company culture to have a healthy work environment. And part of having a healthy company culture is also having white hat management practices where you are looking at the, you know, the KPIs, the performance indicators, the goals, the how do you know if somebody's successful? What are you looking at in each role to know that they're being productive and successful? And that takes management. It takes good management. So I think that remote work often gets blamed for poor performance, because it's actually a bellwether, in my opinion. If you're looking at a remote worker and you're actually paying attention to the metrics and to what you know can make them productive or not, you'll see it faster with a remote worker because you have fewer false positives to be distracted by as you do in the office. Those little benefits of the doubt you give because you might like the person. And not to say you won't like your coworkers for remote. We have, you know, we're an entirely remote team and we've won numerous culture awards, including Outside Magazine's Top 50 Companies to Work For last year. And we have for years won culture awards. So it's not that it can't happen, but this blind reliance or comfort level with being in an office when quite honestly, office environments nowadays have studies stacked against them that they're not the most productive or the most healthy.
Making flexible working work is a management issue. The number of work hours doesn't affect productivity. According to research, the average employee stays productive for less than 3 hours a day, regardless of how much time they spend in the office. To create an engaged, motivated, and productive workforce takes leadership. We need managers to trust employees and provide them with enough context, coaching, and guidance to manage their deliverables in a way that makes sense for them. Here, Sarah shares what leaders can do to start this process.
I'm a big believer in the keep it simple, stupid concept, the KISS methodology, which means have a conversation. Start it off by having a conversation with your team. If you're starting it off with an individual team, if you're starting it off company-wide, bring the key players in and have a conversation about what are the thoughts around this? What are the desires? What do people want? What kinds of flexibility do people want? Is it the option to work remotely? And is it the option to work remotely once a week? Is it the option to work remotely 3 times a week? Or is it the option to work remotely occasionally? At the same time as looking at the benefits that they're hoping to gain from it, which companies should explore, also talk about the fears. What are people worried about if this happens? Is it that you're afraid you're not going to be able to collaborate with your team? You're not going to be able to get a hold of coworkers, that people aren't going to be working? Talk them out, get them out in the air and write them down. Put together a plan of here are the goals, here are the concerns, and find some sense of consensus. Obviously, I would never want organizations to approach it that you're going to find the magic solution for every single person, but find an area that feels comfortable for the majority of people where they are willing to move forward and take a gamble, a calculated risk, that they can set up a structure to see if they can gain the benefits and not get into the negative area, the fear area. And I always recommend trials, setting it up for a 1-month, 3-month trial. And what data points are you going to be looking at along the way that measure against those benefits and those fears and how you're going to track it? Pay attention to the ROI of this and then check in and then iterate on it after the trial is done. It's really not that complicated. Every single concern or example can get fit into that structure. And it might, you know, there might be companies who have the conversation, it feels too complicated and they, you know, there's too many fears and we're not going to do this now. All right, then when are you going to maybe try it again? Because some of these interests aren't going to go away. I will say that I never advocate for the fact that every role is entirely remote. While our company is entirely remote and we have people in a wide variety of roles, from marketing to research to development, HR to accounting, et cetera, all of them being remote and we're running a successful company and have for 13 years, that our culture is built around that. But a hybridized culture of working in an office and then having remote elements integrated is harder. It's something that you do want to make sure that people who are out of an office are syncing well with the people in the office and that they're being treated in a way that is respectful and ideally equally when possible. But not every role in an organization will be identified as being entirely remote friendly. I encourage individuals to look at what their role is and how much of it is done independently by a phone, computer, and that type of mobile device. Those are the tasks that can be done remotely. You don't need to be sitting in a room with somebody for those. And I think people, if they really look at it that way, will be astounded at how much can actually be done remotely.
It makes sense to focus on specific goals and tasks instead of the time employees spend at work. A flexible work culture allows employees to maintain a healthier work-life balance, which leads to better productivity. When employees are able to manage their time properly, they can achieve more while spending less time at work. Best of all, this issue not only supports men and women, but it's also critical to closing the gender gap in leadership positions. Sarah's advice on how leaders can approach this is so valuable. So I hope you all enjoyed today's episode, and feel free to share this with your boss and colleagues, as flexibility is an issue that affects all of us. Before I go, just to mention, if you're interested in partnering with us or being a guest on the show, then please reach out through our website, thefixpodcast.org. You can also sign up to our weekly newsletter and contribute your story there. Thanks again, and I'll catch you all again next week.